This is an enormous undertaking with significant risk. Everyone, I think, realizes that.
BP and ConocoPhillips lay out their gas line plan. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 7th of April. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a militia organizer takes root on the Kenai Peninsula.
I believe that the federal government is going to make a mistake. They will not be able to come back from that. That will ignite a rebellion.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by the Association of Alaska School Boards, working with school districts statewide to bring innovation to classrooms through digital learning for the 21st century. Information at aasb.org.
BP and ConocoPhillips filed a natural gas pipeline plan with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission today and plan to take bids from gas shippers, including themselves, beginning in July. They call their plan the Denali Project. The other major shipper, ExxonMobil, is part of a competing pipeline project with TransCanada. A separate open season plan for that project was approved by FERC a week ago and begins at the end of this month. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
There are substantial differences between the two plans. TransCanada is projecting a cost of as much as $41 million for the gas line, while Denali's estimate is lower at $35 billion. And that lower cost estimate leads to a lower offer for what the project would charge shippers to move gas from the North Slope to the Canadian Gas Distribution Hub in Alberta, or points in between. TransCanada's offer is between $2.80 and $3.50 for million BTU. Denali's offer, disclosed today, is $2.67 to $3.25. Denali President Doug Fackrell says he has a lot of confidence in their cost estimate, but he's not so sure the producers are ready to bid.
This is an enormous undertaking with significant risk. Everyone, I think, realizes that.
Among the risks Fackrell listed were uncertainty about whether the Point Thompson gas project will proceed and about the state's future tax structure on gas production, but also potential new sources for gas are emerging, imports of liquefied gas and increasing production from shale deposits. These make the Lower 48's current soft market for natural gas even more competitive.
So it isn't like we're sitting here and they're begging us to send them gas. We are going to have to compete. And to do that, we've got to have an economic project, and then we've got to compete heads up with any of these other alternatives.
Fackrell refused to make any comparisons between Denali's terms and those of the TransCanada project, which takes advantage of $500 million in state subsidies under the Alaska Gas Inducement Act, or AGIA. Fackrell says, at least for now, that deal shuts off the possibility of a merger between the two competing pipeline schemes.
TransCanada is a AGIA licensee, and they're bound by the terms and conditions of AGIA. Our owners do not agree with the terms and conditions of AGIA. In fact, all of the producers don't agree with all the terms. And so it's problematic for those two to join together at this point. But our owners are entertaining any party that can add value to our project to move forward.
One of those parties is the state government, which not only controls the tax structure, but also will be a shipper of its own royalty share of the gas. Governor Sean Parnell's reaction to the Denali open season announcement was positive. He told reporters today he sees no reason for the state to take any further actions at this time.
Let's let this work the way it seems to have been working, where companies are actually forming partnerships and bringing projects together. Let's stay the course here.
Parnell was particularly pleased to see the timetables for the two open seasons. For a period of a few weeks, both open seasons will be going on at the same time, opening the way to active competition.
When you see the Denali project now having an open season that overlaps the TransCanada Exxon open season, those are two projects that appear to be merging from a commercial perspective. And to me, that's positive for Alaskans. That means that the parties are moving closer together, closer in alignment.
In making their bids, the producers can attach conditions. Bud Fackrell told reporters at a press briefing today that he fears those bids may be heavily conditioned.
The shippers need to sell their gas into a market, and we know that the North American market is very volatile right now. The open season will help us understand if they're willing to commit gas resources into that market or not.
Fackrell says if the bids do not work out, Denali is prepared to look at a scaled-down project. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
TransCanada's estimate is $41 billion, not $41 million. Governor Sean Parnell today presented what's important to him before the end of session, scheduled now for April 18th.
This is the time in the legislative session when real work gets done.
Parnell said his focus during the next 11 days will be a list of bills that he says are necessary for the state's economy. He outlined them in a letter to legislative leaders today. He wants oil tax credits, a reduction in the tourism head tax, a suspension of the state gasoline tax, a new performance-based scholarship program, and a capital budget that includes money for maintenance work needed on state properties.
It's hard to weight these. That's why I said, and I've told the legislators, if this package passes, we can stand together and assure Alaskans that there will be more jobs and more economic opportunity for us as a people than without these pieces.
The governor met with reporters in anticipation of the release of a capital projects budget in the Senate Finance Committee, and he pointed to a divide among Alaskans on how jobs are created. One is the private sector, the other is state money. He wants to see both sources used.
The package that I have includes tax incentives for new investment, new job creation, and it includes things like a deferred maintenance plan where there's public spending going to private sector contractors to do work. That's the kind of combination that I see working long-term for Alaska. I don't think we should depend upon a huge or bloated capital budget to fuel us over time.
Parnell did not hesitate when reporters asked if he plans to call a special session if he isn't satisfied with the results of the current one.
Absolutely. I mean, the number one priority for Alaskans is they want us to focus on the economy, and they want jobs now and opportunity in the future. So it really depends what shapes up with this package from an economic perspective. But again, there in the life of the legislature, there's a lot of time left to get this accomplished.
Late this afternoon, the Senate released its version of the capital projects budget, showing an increase of $514 million over spending the governor requested. It increases grants for nonprofits and includes more money for deferred maintenance. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, sending a rehabilitated eagle back to the wild.
Sometimes people do get attachments to them if they've been here for a while, but it is different. It's a wild animal.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Norman Olson is a former teacher, preacher, and gun salesman. The Nikiski resident transplanted his family and a few friends from Michigan several years ago to settle in Alaska. This in itself is not unusual, as many disenchanted with life in the lower 48 travel north to seek a new start. What is unusual is that Olson came here to start an independent Alaska militia. And as KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, his group has ties to militias on a national hate watch list.
An explosion nationally in the number of citizen militia groups is being monitored with caution by the Southern Poverty Law Center, SPLC's Heidi Byrick.
basically the bad economy has been long linked to rise in extremism. Also, the 1990s militia movement took off around the time that Clinton took over in office. And oftentimes when the national politics moves to the left, you get a reaction in the far, far reaches of the right. And that's, of course, the case today, too, with Obama and the Democrats. And there's a larger thing going on as well, which is that the country is changing demographically. And there are a lot of people who are having a hard time accepting those massive cultural changes.
The Law Center keeps a hate watch list of radical right, anti-government, and racial hate groups state by state, and Alaska Citizens Militia tops the list for our state. The recent arrest of 9 Hutari militia members in Michigan and other Midwest states for a plot to murder police officers has only spiked concerns about the activities of radical right groups. But Alaska Citizens Militia founder Norm Olson says militia members are not trying to cause trouble.
We are not anti-government. We are anti-tyranny and anti-oppression.
He says the root of the militia movement is fear.
I believe that Alaskans are aware and awake. They are, like many Americans, deeply disturbed at what the federal government is trying to do. And we are seeing the wasting away of our rights and our liberties by the encroachment of the federal government. And people are alarmed. And so that fear of the tyrannical or oppressive behavior of the federal government, let's call it the central government, causes fear in the people, and fear causes people to react.
Olson spoke from his home in Nikiski, a 30-plus acre spread which he is using as a militia training center. Olson's militia efforts go back a long way to the state of Michigan in the 1990s. He and partner Ray Southwell were instrumental in establishing militias in a couple of dozen Michigan counties, armed militias. Olson had made a national name for himself in those days, even testifying before a U.S. Senate subcommittee hearing on domestic terrorism after the Oklahoma City bombing.
We are people who love our government and love the Constitution. We're proud of the United States of America. But the thing that we stand against is corruption. We stand against oppression and tyranny in government. And we, many of us, are coming to the conclusion that you best represent that corruption and tyranny.
Olson uses that word tyranny a lot. He quotes the founding fathers easily and is obviously well-read when it comes to the history of the United States. He also relies on God.
I've been a Baptist preacher for more than 20 years, but about 15 years ago, the Baptists seemed to be growing more and more moderate, and their voices were not being heard as they were in the colonial days, and so I took the name Baptist off the church, and we simply call this church the Freedom Church. We're a gospel church, evangelical church. But what we do is we blend the Word of God. We blend that with current day situations, looking at the political changes, the threats, the corruption, the unrighteousness, the wickedness in high places. And we point that out and show that we are in a time today that is revealed in Scripture to be what we call the last days.
Olson has no problem mixing God and guns. SPLC's Byrick says that mix is a common thread among so-called patriot groups.
There have been militias that have, put themselves under the cover of a church, which provides certain tax benefits as well. So I'm not surprised to see Olson doing that. And Christianity is, of course, pretty fervent in these circles. Not every one of these groups, openly says we are a Christian militia like the Hutare did, but Christianity is the religion of choice in these circles.
Byrick says Oklahoma City bombers Terry Nichols and Timothy McVeigh attended Michigan militia meetings. Should Olson's group be a concern to Alaskans?
So the movement itself is something to be concerned about. Olson in particular doesn't have a history of violence.
But Olson says these trying times have not brightened his picture any about the state of the United States government and its eventual collapse.
I mean, we're seeing such a revival of patriotic spirit in America. America is rising up in great numbers to oppose the threat that we face from the Obama regime, and also, again, this growing threat from centralized government.
He says right now his organization is providing and equipping its members with information, material goods, and guns, if requested.
When will that final travesty of justice or that final move by the tyrants against the people, what will that kick that off? I believe we're getting very, very close. I believe that the federal government is going to make a mistake. They will not be able to come back from that. They will move against the people in such a way that the people will push back, and that will ignite a rebellion.
Olson says he stands ready to protect the rights of the American people. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Fisheries experts say a warming Bering Sea may adversely affect pollock stocks. KUCB's Ann Hillman reports.
Franz Munter is an assistant professor at the University of Alaska's School of Fisheries and Ocean Science. He and his colleagues are trying to predict how climate change might affect the fisheries of the Bering Sea.
So we thought in general that pollock would be one of the species that might benefit from warmer temperatures. And that thinking has changed completely.
Motor says that on one hand, warming might decrease the size of the cold pool of water that sits on the seafloor and thus increase the area that subarctic fish can inhabit.
And essentially what you see is that as the temperatures warm in the Bering Sea, most of these populations tend to move further north on average.
Studies show that fish ranges moved north about 7.5 miles each decade for the past 30 years. Warming might also increase the productivity of some of the smaller organisms that make up the bottom of the food chain, but not some of the larger ones, like the copepods that young pollock feed on. Overall productivity could go up, but some species would be harmed in the process. The problem is that changes to one aspect of the ecosystem, like fish location or phytoplankton abundance, can completely alter how the system works as a whole.
Interaction between different species changes, and lots of things in the system will change that we just can't really predict. But if the system functions the way it has over the past several decades, if the rules of the games don't change, we would expect that pollock will be one of the species that may be a loser in the Bering Sea.
Mutter bases this prediction partially on data from the early 2000s. During those years, the Bering Sea experienced some of the warmest temperatures on record and some of the worst years for pollock recruitment.
And so what we think happened is that there were just not enough of those large, juicy copepods around to allow the young pollock to put on enough fat reserves to make it through the winter.
So Mutter and his colleagues think that if the Bering Sea continues to warm, as is predicted by sea surface temperature models, it may not be very good for pollock, but it might help other species.
We're going to probably see large changes in the species mix, so there are going to be winners and losers. But if overall production really does increase, there'll be something around for fishermen to catch, and there'll be fairly high fishery production still.
However, with all of the changes that a warming climate could bring, it's unclear exactly what will happen. In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
A Fairbanks man has invented a solar focusing lens technology that promises more efficient, lower cost energy collection. Inventor John Pender says the idea is to use tiny prisms to direct and concentrate the sun.
If you could manufacture a whole bunch of little prism shaped volumes of liquid crystal, 20 sheets of paper thick, you can steer the sun all you want.
Pender patented the prism lens 3 years ago, and his company Goldstream Solar recently received a federal Small Business Innovation Research Grant to make prototypes of the solar concentration lenses. Pender says the liquid crystal prisms enable a fixed panel to achieve what's only been possible in the past with large, expensive lenses and mechanized solar tracking systems.
If you're in the concentrated solar power biz, you only have two choices. You can mount your device on a telescope and put it on a big pedestal and then take the pedestal and embed it in concrete and then have the whole thing move back and forth and up and down as the sun moves, or you can use my thing.
Pender says his prismatic lens paired with a very efficient solar cell can harvest vastly more energy than traditional solar panel setups.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. Connect with Alaska businesses seeking qualified Alaskans for hundreds of jobs in oil and gas, healthcare, and dozens of other career fields by visiting Alexis, the state of Alaska's virtual career center. When you register at alexsys.alaska.gov, your experience and qualifications will be matched with real-time job postings from Alaska employers. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
The Anchorage Assembly should have three new members thanks to yesterday's municipal election. Dick Traney, Paul Honeman, and Ernie Hall won the approval of voters. But Traney was leading Andy Clary by less than 200 votes this afternoon. The last batch of absentee ballots won't be tallied until April 16th. Anchorage Daily News columnist Michael Carey has been following the action. He says he expects Traney to hold on to his lead, and he doesn't think the election will change much in city government.
I understand there are people on both sides, Democrats, Republicans, conservatives, liberals, who think the government is about to take a dramatic turn, but I think if it got better for Mayor Sullivan, it's only marginal, and if it got worse for him, it's only marginal, too.
So you don't really see this election as changing the balance of power on the Assembly?
Not particularly. And, Dick Traney has been known in some ways as a conservative, but he also ran against a very conservative candidate in this race and made a number of liberal allies. So he's going to be very, very important. In some ways, it's really important because of his personality.
How big of an upset is it for Matt Clayman to lose his seat?
I don't think a lot of people who follow politics were surprised they lost. I think they were surprised that he lost by such a decisive margin. This was clearly a rebuke to him.
What do you think's going on there?
First of all, Ernie Hall is very popular. He's been around Anchorage a long time. Many people know him. He's very civically engaged. He's had a business here for a long time. But it just seems that Clayman, as temporary mayor or as acting mayor and as assemblyman, somehow had worn out his welcome with the voters in that district. I find it very unusual that he got beaten that badly.
Michael, how did voters feel about the bonds on the ballot?
Well, as my old buddy Frank Gurjevic at the Anchorage Daily News pointed out to me, many of these bond results were very, very close. So it's quite clear they had very mixed feelings, the voters did, about passing them. And remember, something like only 17% of the voters turned out for this election. But the ones who turned out had mixed feelings, and they turned down the bus bonds.
Why do you think voters rejected the transportation bond?
That seems to be the one thing that they have the most heartburn about traditionally, is they don't ride the bus, so they don't think it's particularly necessary. Some of them. We're talking about the people who make the difference in these kinds of elections. On the other hand, everybody uses the roads, and most of the time, people feel roads are a big necessity, although this time, it was pretty close.
And what about school board election results?
That was striking. Jeannie Mackey won. She'd been appointed and ran for a term, and she won decisively, getting more than 50% of the vote. And Don Smith, in school board seat A, ran as the conservative father of the tax cap. He got about 40% of the vote, and the liberal progressive teacher union vote was split between O'Malley and LaBelle, and Don Smith won.
Well, Michael, as you noted earlier, the voter turnout was low. How low was it, and were you surprised by this?
Well, we'll have to know how low it is when the final reports are in. We're still getting those when they count on the absentee question, but this was an election that did not generate a tremendous amount of interest, despite what people said last summer when they thought that the equal rights legislation would spur a big interest in this election. And I think that when you get a low turnout, what you get is a not much change election, and I think that's what we got.
Michael Carey is a columnist for the Anchorage Daily News. The Alaska Raptor Center released four eagles last weekend, three juveniles and an adult. Releasing four at a time is fairly rare. The Raptors Center has been treating eagles for 30 years, and its regular eagle releases often draw spectators. As KCAW's Ed Ronco reports, the moment an eagle flies away is the beginning of a second chance for the bird and the end of a long process for the center's staff and volunteers.
On this Saturday morning, inside the Alaska Raptor Center, veterinarian Victoria Vosberg is using a Dremel tool to give an eagle a pedicure.
So we really sharpen these talons up. We want to give these birds every chance possible in the wild.
All right, it's not really a pedicure. It's an exit physical given to this bird, an adult female named Honor.
They sometimes get dull in captivity, and sometimes we trim them so that they don't injure themselves or the other birds.
Honor is one of four eagles going back into the wild today. Vosberg is working on the birds with a team of staff and volunteers. Honor is a little worked up. Listen, you can hear her breathing. So she's handed off to volunteer Rita White, who sits outside, letting her cool off. White is clutching the bird's 2 feet with her own arms, keeping the eagle's massive wings folded. White started volunteering at the Raptor Center not long after moving to Sitka a few months ago.
My husband is a traveling nurse, and I thought this would be an opportunity of a lifetime. How many places can you go and see eagles this close?
Is this your first time holding an eagle?
I've held its feet before, but up close and personal, the first, yeah.
What's it like?
It's pretty neat.
Getting to work with volunteers is one of the things Vosberg says she likes about her job.
Let's see, I moved here in 93, and I am not even remotely tired of it. I still love working with the eagles. I get excited when we get a new eagle in.
Working at the Raptor Center is only one part of Vosberg's work as a veterinarian. She also treats dogs and cats at Sitka Animal Hospital.
It is very busy, yes.
And even though she's treating animals at both places, Vosberg says the two jobs are very different.
When I'm dealing with dogs and cats, I'm dealing with a loved member of the family. And here I'm dealing with an animal. People do get attachments to them if they've been here for a while. But it is different. It's a wild animal.
And because the Raptor Center is working with wild animals, only two get treated at any one time so that there's plenty of hands and eyes focused on the same thing just to make sure nothing goes wrong. As a second pair of eagles are being worked up in the clinic about 20 minutes later, Rita White is still sitting outside with Honor, who by now has stopped huffing and puffing and is resting her head.
How's it going?
I think my hands are numb.
Despite the numb hands, White never stops smiling, and her smile actually grows a few minutes later when it's finally time to release Honor before a crowd of onlookers.
One, two, three. There we go.
Wow. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Look, he's happy.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ed Ronco in Sitka. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Tech Alaska, working to permit the Red Dog Mine so it can produce for Alaska for another 20 years. Details at reddogalaska.com. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA. Working late? Hear Alaska News Nightly at any time of the day on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.